From an early age, we're all immersed in sport. For some, it fails to ignite a spark inside us, but for those of us who catch the fire, it's the beginning of a lifelong journey filled with highs and lows, which all matter far more than they should. After all, it's just a game, we're told. Sport is a certainty, it's a point of reference in an increasingly uncertain world, and the bonds formed with either sport in general or a hometown club transcend both time and generations. Today, much of what sport has always meant to true fans has been somehow lost in a blizzard of corporate communications, fireworks, and froth. The attachments that were once so strong seem more trivial in the global age of televised sport as entertainment. What was once authentic has become increasingly staged. In this podcast, we'll get back to the things that sport has always meant to true fans. We'll take you from the boardroom, to the dressing room, to the pitch, but we'll do it not as a corporate communication, but as true fans of sport, and we'll do it with authenticity. We'll be honest, and we'll speak our minds. This is a podcast for true sports fans, and the one thing all fans have in common is a passion for the game. Now, we certainly don't mean to cause any offence, so if you find yourself taking any, just shrug it off and get back in the game, because this is about the game, and the game is bigger than all of us. Welcome, everybody, to yet another edition of Are You Not Entertained? Joining me, as always, is my co-host, the one, the only, Roger Mitchell. Roger, where are you?
I'm in Como. Good morning, Grant. It's Monday morning, and another week gets on its way, and what better way to start than to get back to a goal and just talk about what's going on. How are you?
I am good, yes. I've had a busy week, some of which will constitute part of my goal on goal. So I'm
not going to
tell you more about that at the moment. But as always, Roger, well, except in fact, not quite as always but once, when I was desperate not to let you take what I knew you were going to have as one of my goal or own goals, I'm going to let you go first. What have you got for me?
Well, you know, before the goal on goal, we had John Hopkins.
Wasn't he wonderful?
Yeah, yeah. You know, I love those ones. You know, we had Phil Liggett and it was the exact same vibe, I felt anyway. But, you know, I wanted to tell you because, I've got a lot of mates in the whole journalism industry. I met a lot of them and remained friends when I was doing that job. A lot of them came on and they said, you know, they actually found the episode, quotes, very sad. You know, they enjoyed it, but they said it was very sad because it reminded them in a genuine way, but sadly in a difficult way, of how those days are totally gone. You know, I'm reading one here. It says, John's comments, quotes, "just be there," all very well, but when you don't have a desk that's prepared to fund you to go to Peterborough, never mind, you know, Port Elizabeth, what does that mean? You know, so there was a lot of people who couldn't look at it the way we did as fans, as readers, but they looked at it as a mirror on their profession. And they found it, as I say, quite difficult.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it hadn't really occurred to me. Obviously, I'm listening to it as a fan. I have to admit, I'm very surprised to learn that when you were the chief executive of the SPL, that you had friends who were journalists.
But
Phew. Yeah, right. But no, I hadn't thought of it that way. But it makes sense. I mean, you know, I think as a fan, you bemoan the loss of the sort of innocence of your sporting youth. And I'm sure that is the same for every generation. I mean, I dread to think what people who are growing up with sports journalism these days are going to mourn. I mean, think what it's going to look like for them to mourn this, Rog. But you know, it's a great point. I mean, it is a great point. The storytellers have gone because if people do get the latitude to tell stories these days, they're told to make them quick, you know. And the beauty of a story is sitting around listening to it unfold. So I guess the two are at odds.
And you know, the reason I wanted to bring it up is because you yourself very much are in that space. You know, you and your style of journalism in the financial world is long form. It's the John Hopkins type of understand the person more than what the person's doing. And you know how difficult it is to find a model to pay for that. And, you know, I think that's what we touched on.
Well, I personally, I think that pendulum is starting to swing back. It's barely perceptible, but I really get a sense that people miss this. And I think people are missing the beauty of a long form story. And you can see it in the media, particularly in the UK, you know, all these long reads that are coming up. Now, yeah. A long read these days, it says long read, 12 minutes, you know, which is a lifetime in today's world. But it's starting to come back. And I think once you start going back down that road, Rog, I hope the journey is as inevitable to the other end of the pendulum as the journey to short form was. Yeah, I hope so too, because it's, if you've got the time to read it, you always enjoy these things. And if you don't have the time to read it, then, you know, I think you find the time once you've been exposed to this sort of stuff. So I dearly hope you're absolutely right.
When you're talking about long reads there, I have now seen The Irishman.
okay.
And I came across an article, a very long read, from actually one of the new publishers, Vox, which, anyway, I won't bore you with the story of BuzzFeed and Vox and people like that, but they were the new digital breed, and you know, so they're, as you say, they're maybe going towards long form. I get what you were saying about The Irishman, Grant, but, you know, here's what I thought about it, very quickly. You know, this is clearly the end of the chapter of himself, Scorsese, and all those actors. And whilst one could critically say, maybe you could cut a wee bit off here and there, I wouldn't have even for that, but let's say you wanted to get it below 3.5 hours. Surely you just want to savour the very last times that you're going to have these guys facing off each other and that kind of level of acting. I just sat there and said, I'll never see this again. Pesci and De Niro just, you know, looking at each other, not commenting. And, you know, Scorsese himself, this article was saying his whole career is about his search for God and the conflicts he's got from the temptation of Christ. Anyway, this isn't a movie thing. I'm not bright enough for that. But what I'm saying, since you mentioned it the last time, I just thought it was a treat from the start to the finish.
Yeah, interesting. It's funny, I've was chatting with someone yesterday at lunch, and he said something that really struck me. He said, you know, why is it today that everything has to be either absolutely brilliant or awful? He said, you know, The Irishman was a very, very good film, but why does it have to be one side or the other? And I guess that speaks to this polarization problem we've got.
Yeah.
You know, and the overload of superlatives. You have to either praise something to the heavens or bash it to the depths, and that was right. You know, I thought it was a very, very good film. It really was. I mean, is it the best film I've ever seen? No, not by some way. Is it the best film I've seen with those actors in it? No, but there was a lot to enjoy about it. And you know, Roger, one of these days I will probably watch it again just to kind of see what's what, and I may, you know, take my time watching it, watch it over a couple of nights. But but you know what Colin said to me was absolutely right. You know, it's we do live in a world where things are either the best thing ever or the worst thing ever, and that's a real shame.
Yeah. Anyway, what was it you asked me? Goal, own goal?
Sorry about it. Yeah. What do you got for me this week?
Goal, I'm going to go for a small Mexican chap. I think his name is Ruiz, who on Saturday night took on Anthony Joshua. And I just was so full of admiration for that small fat guy. Maybe that's projecting on myself in that case, but but you know, did you see everything about what he presented himself with? His team looked like out of a Fellini film. You know, there was this guy singing the Mexican national anthem, and he looks dreadful. He looks as if he's never been in a gym in his life. But what a chin, what a heart. And he took that fight to supposedly the greatest boxer around these days, who frankly used his long left arm to keep out of harm's way and never really engaged. So, you know, I think that that Mexican chap just did so much good. And, you know, the context of this, Grant, is that we said maybe at the start of season one of this podcast that maybe DAZN was going to bring in a new golden era of boxing. And, you know, I think they're going in that direction. You know, by the way, we're probably going to have Joe Markovsky from DAZN on the podcast early in January. Joe's the guy you always see, apart from putting these things together professionally, he's the guy that's kind of what I call the bridge between old type sport and the new models and the new personalities. And he feels himself at ease with John Skipper, his boss, ex-ESPN, ESPN boss, as well as Logan Paul. So Joe's going to give us an idea, I think, of exactly what's happening in sport with the new generations. But, you know, DAZN, I think, have re-energized the sport. And what I would say to them is I really hope they can stop messing around now and they can get AJ in the ring with Tyson Fury. Would that not be a great fight?
Look, it would be a great fight. And sadly, over the last sort of 15, maybe 20 years, what's happened with all these big fights is there's always been a lot of talk, and then both the protagonists have eventually come together to make that fight for big bucks when they were, you know, close to the end of their careers. And I think that none of them have really wanted to face each other in their prime in any of these weights. I mean, the heavyweight division is a little different, I guess. But, you know, you look at Manny Pacquiao, right? He didn't do the big fights until late in his career. You look at Roy Jones Jr., you look at, I mean, I guess Mayweather's a bit different. And I didn't see the fight on Saturday night, unfortunately. I was deep in a conversation with a whole bunch of people. We planned to go to the pub and watch it, and we didn't get to it, unfortunately, which shows you how good the conversation was. But you know, when I was talking about it yesterday over lunch, you know, the subject of the whole Saudi thing came up.
And of course.
And it was very interesting to hear the different views about it from people, you know, and as somebody said, you know, the grief that these sports stars get for taking these purses, and as somebody said yesterday, you know, why are you putting it on people like AJ to make a stand if the UK government won't? You know, it's like, here's a guy who wants to feed his family, and if the UK government won't make a stand, why are we giving sports stars a hard time for not making a stand? You know, and it's a thorny issue, it's a tricky issue. You know, Rory turned down a huge appearance fee supposedly to play in Saudi this coming year. Sergio's going back, I think, partly in penance for smashing the greens up the year before. But it is interesting, right? I mean, I understand why people are saying that sportsmen as role models should be taking a stand, but it's difficult to do when your government's keen on selling planes and weaponry to them.
Well, I was probably going to keep this a little bit for my own goal. It's part of my own goal, but it's an absolute perfect segue. Sport and politics.
They don't come along very often, Rod, so take it. I'm
going to take it. Megan Rapinoe, or whatever her name is. You know I'm not a fan.
Rapinoe, yeah.
Calling out, pressuring Ronaldo and Messi to make political statements and use their platform and their fame to make political statements about whatever, I guess, she thinks is important in life. And I just think that's dreadfully, dreadfully wrong. You know, first of all, this is the whole theme, isn't it? You know, with what's going on in our life today, it's not enough for them to have an opinion. They need to put it onto somebody else.
Yeah.
The Saudi Arabia thing, even the Qatar thing, there's a million things you could say about that's wrong with sport and politics. But you're right, you know, like, the governments at the macro level do a million worse unethical things. I just don't have a huge problem with it. What I do have a problem with Saudi in this case is their piracy. You know, piracy is going to be the major, major issue in sport as it goes to digital and it goes mobile. It just becomes so easy to rip off. And, you know, they have completely undermined the big sport broadcaster in the region, BN, in a way that obviously is to do with everything about politics. And then they host, you know, the Italian Super Cup final there. So listen, I don't have a problem with trying to use sport to bring these countries more into the mainstream, but they can't just have it both, you know, one side of it. They have to then clean up their act and start behaving as a community. And, you know, that's what my issue with Saudi is, not the fact that, as you say, the sportsman goes there, DAZN goes there. You know, like, I've got a neighbour here, a lovely couple from Congo. Both of them actually are surgeons. And we got talking the other night about Kinshasa and obviously what happened in Kinshasa with Ali Foreman.
Yeah.
And you know, these are obviously incredibly intelligent people. And they obviously were a lot younger at the time and everything like that. But, you know, Simon, what did you feel about, you know, the fact that your leader was ripping off the country, Swiss bank accounts, but got these two and made your country the centre of the world for what turned out to be maybe 6 weeks? And all they remember, and the story they told was, like, you know, the documentary When We Were Kings, they remember Ali running through the townships, you know, training. And they said it made us feel a little bit better. So yeah, these things are never black and white, no, you know, absolutely. And as you were saying earlier, it doesn't have to be crap or great. There's a million shades of grey. And I think Saudi and sport and politics and this girl, I think she still calls herself a girl, I'm not sure about that, Rapinoe, she needs to butt out. You know, because sport is not about a platform to and a soapbox. It's a beautiful thing, and it should be enjoyed for that. And I want to come back and say, that small, fat Mexican guy, I wish I had your heart, mate, because that was so impressive.
Well, I would imagine there was a time in your life when you were wearing a suit to work every day that you wish you had his chin as well, Rog.
Yes, yes. Yeah, what a chin. I mean, he took some unbelievable punches and just kept coming. And fantastic bloke, fantastic. He had nothing going for him, nothing. He's not getting the help he needs from his team, probably. And, you know, he's up for it again, another fight, obviously. Well, but, you know.
Yeah, okay. Well, I guess that's the least surprising part of all of it.
Yeah, well, anyway, that's my goal of the week.
All right, well, I'm going to kick off with my own goal. I've got two fairly, I think will be fairly short own goals, but we'll see. Let's see what happens when I open these particular cans of worms. The first one is Patrick Reed. I don't know if you saw this or not.
I did.
It's shocking to me, frankly. Laughable, it's embarrassing, it's humiliating, For him. I just think it's
awful. Oh, right. Right. You didn't agree with him?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not at all. There is no doubt at all as to what he was doing in my mind. And
tell us a little bit. For those who didn't watch it,
you know, in golf, you're not allowed to improve your lie at any point. And his ball went into a waste bunker. And normally in a bunker.
Oh, sorry. I thought you were talking about the other incident with the cameraman.
Oh, I haven't even seen that one, Rog. I haven't even seen that one. I'm talking about the bunker shot. You've not seen this?
I saw that one as well.
Yeah, okay, fine. Well, you think the other one's worse? Well, this I've got here in
no,
a second.
No, I'm not saying worse. I'm just saying the cameraman, I think, was more a debate. Obviously, you know, flattening out the bunker on your backswing and your practice shot is not on.
No, exactly right. But the thing that I don't understand about this, this is the thing I watch the football and you see some of the cynical stuff that goes on. There are so many cameras these days if you're a professional sportsman, watching everything you do, and particularly with golf, where you know that sitting at home, there is some guy in an armchair with a notepad who's keeping all the statistics, who will phone in. You know, we had this years ago. I remember when, I think it was Craig Stadler was playing Greg Norman. I mean, this would be in the early 80s when there wasn't that much golf on TV. So it would have been one of the big tournaments, maybe the Players' Championship or something, if I remember rightly. And his ball had come to rest in grass near the side of a pond. And so to protect his pants, he put his towel down and knelt on his towel because he had to kneel down and hit the shot out of a bush. And did that, you know, got up, put the towel back in the bag. Some Jobsworth called the PGA from his couch at home and said he was improving his stance by having a towel underneath it, and which to the letter of the law was correct. And he got penalised for it. I mean, it's ridiculous. And that was in that was in the early 80s. So for Reed to very obviously sweep away sand twice to improve his lie, to me, was just shocking. And then, you know, the aftermath, obviously he denied it because, again, we're in the deny, deny, deny world. I think anyone who's played golf, it was blatantly obvious what he was doing. Blatantly obvious. And a lot of pros have come out and, you know, condemned him for it. Our boy Eddie Pepperell put a great tweet up there talking about
what did he say?
He was going to go to the beach and practice with his clubs, but he finished it off with what the F were you thinking, which is exactly what I thought when I saw it. I saw Eddie's tweet later. What's going to be interesting is Reed is now on a plane, I suspect, heading for Melbourne for the President's Cup. And the Aussies will give it to him. I mean, he will be sledged.
Oh, because they don't ball tamper or anything like that. They don't do anything like that.
No, but I'm talking about the fans here. The fans will give it to him because maybe they want an outlet for that. Maybe they'll be offering him sandpaper. I don't know. But look, it may actually work in Reed's favour because he certainly played much better in the Ryder Cup when the fans were distinctly against him. But I think, look, he has a reputation for... You know, for being troublesome, for not being the greatest.
A bit spicy, bit tasty.
Chippy, right,
chippy even.
Chippy.
Yeah.
But look, I mean, I saw that, and as I said, anyone who plays golf knows exactly what he's doing.
Well, we said that with John. Appalling. We said that with John Hopkins. We said, is this not, you know, becoming more and more prevalent? And he said, look, golf's just reflecting society. And whether we agree or not, I think John is saying that standards have fallen and decorum has fallen. But, you know, we mustn't go there. Otherwise, we get into that whole old man moaning about how the new world isn't proper. So,
cheating is cheating. It doesn't matter. Yeah. If the rules are the rules, it doesn't matter if it's old man.
I'm not defending him.
What happened with the cameraman? I didn't see that.
Listen, I only saw it passing by, but he's got the chip near the green. And the camera and the sound guy are pretty close to him. And apparently, the sound guy, I find this hard to believe, but the sound guy is jangling coins in his pocket that puts him off. And he says, right, you've lost your privileges, all of you, get away or I'm not hitting the shot. And like he insists that they get completely, very far away from, and so obviously the coverage is lost, but you know, he makes a big issue of the guy making a noise, which is, I think that's fair enough. You know, like golf, you can't be like jangling your coins beside
unless you're Sevi Ballesteros. But the but was this the day after he got the punishment?
You've got me there. I don't know.
I suspect it was, at which point it fully makes full sense to me why he'd want the cameraman away from him.
Probably. Yeah.
Once bitten, twice shy.
Right, what else did you have? That was a good one. What, you had a second one there?
I did, and you're going to love this one. My second own goal is Scottish football, FITBA.
Right, okay.
Now, I saw the highlights of the Fraser Forster show yesterday, which was remarkable from what I could see. But I do wonder, Rog, I have to say, and congratulations to Celtic for winning their 10th trophy in a row, but that's my own goal. To have a league where one team can win 10 trophies in a row, I don't know. That's not great, I've got to say. I mean, as a Celtic fan, it's wonderful. As a fan of any other Scottish team in the league, I'm sure it's awful. But as a neutral, it doesn't make me want to watch Scottish football. I mean, it just doesn't. I'm like, well, okay, there's one good team, and what's the point?
Well, there's a lot to say about that.
I don't know
where to start. Right, let's just do it in a very, very practical way. Keep all the emotion out of it. Otherwise, we'll get into a lot of weeds here.
$50 says you get into the emotion.
No, I'm not. I'm definitely not. Look, Scottish football's always been about Celtic and Rangers. It's been 30 years since anybody else has won the league. The Dundee United and Aberdeens in the early 80s are gone. Scottish football is Celtic and Rangers. Rangers liquidated. They weren't demoted. Some of the English commentators talking about this game this week in the build-up, you know, you've got one job, get the story right. They weren't demoted. They didn't go into administration. They ceased to exist. They liquidated. They had to apply to get into the league afresh. They did that and they got their way back up the leagues in 4 or 5 years. In that time, Celtic had really no opposition and, as you say, won everything. Now, Rangers are back. You know, Rangers deserved to win that game yesterday. Stevie G has done a magnificent job, full of admiration for him. And I think you're taking the wrong side of this. I think you could have made that your own goal for any time over the last 5 years. But now I think you're about to see a real challenge.
A resurgence of another club. So there's two now.
Well, we could say that about a lot. How many clubs are there in Spain that really matter? Or in Holland, there's three. Belgium, you know, again, you guys in England, you kind of look at things in your own little narrow way. The world is polarizing and there's teams that are what I call Hollywood clubs that can win stuff and everybody else that's playing for a community play, like we heard Simon Hallett say. So Scotland's no different than that. But I think, to take your point, I think the days of Celtic, you know, being in second gear and picking up these trophies is over. They should have lost yesterday. Obviously, the big context is the next 18 months, whether we can win this league to go 9 in a row, and then the holy grail of winning 10 in a row, which nobody has ever done. And Stevie G is going to stop it, they think. Yesterday, on my what I saw with my eyes, I'm very concerned. You know, I'm not living in Glasgow anymore, so I don't have the whole bragging rights thing in the office this morning and, you know, what fans do. And I look from afar and I'm slightly concerned, mate, because they're back.
Well, I guess we can agree to disagree on that. I mean, I take your point about the other leagues, but I think in Spain you've had the Valencias, you've had the Sevillas come through, and the Atletico Madrid, Bilbao. You've had them win things regularly over that period, which does add a little spice. I mean, I guess we're spoilt here in England with you've probably got every year 6 or 8 teams that could compete, and very quickly that comes down to 4. But normally, right through the end of the year into the early part of the second year of the season, there are multiple teams who can win the title, which is always interesting. It'll be interesting to see what happens this year if Leicester can keep up with Liverpool. But I just watched it, and I'm just thinking, if I'm an armchair fan, I don't know if I just want to watch Celtic win 10.
No, but you're not anymore. You're not anymore. I think in the next 18 months, and let's say you're going to have something between 6 to 8 Old Firm games in those next 18 months. Those are going to be some of the most important and compelling games you'll see anywhere in the world of football, because the tension is really, really ramping up now. You know, like dramatically ramping up. And I saw a lot of English folk there. I think Ferdinand was at the game yesterday, Rio Ferdinand. You saw a lot of commentators in England. They know, you know, I can't blame them for the last 5 years that they checked out because Rangers weren't around. But now it's back. You've got Gerrard, which is a big English story. You know, Celtic and Rangers are both doing well in Europe. You know, brackets. Lazio is third in Serie A. They beat Juventus at the weekend. We tanned them twice, home and away. You know, Celtic and Rangers are back. And with very limited funds, both of them are doing a really good job. And, you know, keep your eye on that one, because in the next, as I say, the next 6 or 8 Old Firm games are going to be dramatic.
For those of you listening at home, a tanning is a good old-fashioned beating. Okay, all right. Well, I will watch it. If Rangers can turn Celtic over a few times, I have to say my ears will prick up. But it's sad that I'm happy because there's now not one team in the running; it's two again. But anyway, never mind. Let's leave that, Rog, and let's have your own goal.
Well, my own goal, you're going to have to help me with this one, Grant, because you're balanced and you're smart and everything like that. I'm going to pick up on what we said the last podcast that we parked, which was Balotelli. You remember that?
Yes, 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 I do.
And of course, since then, we've had racism come back up into
Did it ever really go away though, Rog?
No, that's the point. This is my point, mate. This is my point. So help me with this. We've got two elements to it. We've got the Balotelli career thing and whether him being racially abused, which absolutely has, I can tell you, in Italy, it's not the way it is in Britain, has in some way created a character as a sportsman for him that has basically been self-destructive. That's what we said in the last podcast. I'd like you to tell me what you think about that. But then, you know, you've got the racism again, Fred for Man United. And my point is this, and as I say, I want you to take it forward because I thought about it and I don't have anything new, fresh to say to myself, is this. Racism is the symptom. The real issue is whether we like it or not, a certain percentage of football fans are very, very low down on the evolution curve. These are not clever people. These are not rational people. These are people who, in my opinion, use football to take out their anger. Frankly, they're going there to abuse somebody in some form, and whichever weakness in their eyes you display will be what they abuse you on. If you're a black person, it will be racism. If you are a Catholic in some places, it will be that. If you're a short guy, it will be that. If you're bald, it will be that. Now, how come racism seems to then become the thing? When the thing is this, football is, in many cases, not a very pleasant environment. And why can't we just get our head around that? You're not going to change the X percent of fans who do not have the brain to realise that they're stupid.
Roger, I mean, I don't know where to start myself on this. I mean, look, as I grew up in Britain, the culture was always finding things in people to make fun of, and you made fun of your mates, and you've made fun of your mates, right? You'd rip
that's
them.
It. He's got a big chin. Yeah, that's
right,
it.
Right. That was where it came from, and it wouldn't matter. It was whatever it was that made you different that you'd
that's
make
it.
Fun of, right? Which is fine, right? And I, you know, I had mates who were tall and lanky and skin and fat and black and white and all kinds of stuff, right? And we were all mates. And it was always your Achilles heel that you'd go for. But it was done to people you knew who you knew that you were mates. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So I think you have that. You have that undertone. And, you know, when you go to a football match, then you have that in the background as your kind of default thing to do.
Yeah.
You don't know them. You don't have a relationship with these guys. Maybe some people they do, and I'm certainly not excusing it because I actually agree with everything you've said. I'm just trying to understand where it comes from. You know, I think the problem with racism in football was there in the 80s. You know, I remember when Viv Anderson was the first black player to play for England. You know, what a huge, huge deal it was back at that time, which you think about now is absolutely impossible to believe. You know, I don't understand it in Italy. It seems to be in parts of Europe pretty virulent, and it seems to be, particularly in the Eastern European nations, really, really nasty. And it's a problem. It felt like it went away a bit for a while. What I struggle to understand is why it's back so strongly now. You know, we had a number of years where there were a few isolated incidents. And now it seems to be every week you read about one of these. And I don't know if that's a reflection on the polarization of society again, Roger.
Yep,
and it's a much deeper societal problem rather than, to your point, an educational level problem or anything. I suspect that has something to do with it. But look, I struggle to disagree with anything you said. I really do. I think you're absolutely right. There is an intelligent spectrum amongst the football fan community, and thankfully, the ones that we're being pejorative against won't have figured out how to turn their iPods on and download this, so we'll be okay because they won't be listening. There is a problem with that, and I don't know how you address that. How do you address a lack of intelligence?
Well, let me tell you this again. With the job I used to do, certainly up there, I got to know a lot of police guys, senior police guys, match commanders, chief police officers.
But every time you were interviewed, you hadn't seen anything though, Rog, right?
Never saw a thing. Just like Arsene Wenger, never saw it.
There you go.
So you would spend some time with these guys, especially, and a couple of things I'd like to say about that. You know, they would tell you, the police, with who I've got, once you see them operating as match commanders, your respect for them goes up enormously.
Can you do me one favour?
Yeah.
Can you please call them the police for me just once?
The police.
That's it.
Police. The police. The police, you got to respect them because they would say to you, look, you know, what, you think, in Scotland's case, you think sectarianism is going to go away? No, eventually maybe it'll be diluted to a point that it doesn't matter anymore, but it'll be slow. It will not go away overnight. Correct, they would say. So what's the role of football? The role of football is the release valve. It is better that they throw out all their bile in the confines of a stadium that we can control rather than they take it into the pubs tonight. So put that in your cap and go and think about it. And this is the police telling me this, you know? And folks don't realise the role of football in a lot of cases is exactly that. You have got working class guys, of which you and I are both, working class guys that use football as the kind of the way it always was meant to be. You would come out the mine and then Saturday would be your day of rest in the afternoon where you would go and watch your team. And it was a release and you were able to like get all your frustrations out about how shit your life was and how much you were not going anywhere and everything like that. That's always been football, the working class game's role. Now, that ain't going to change. And, you know, now it's been kind of like kidnapped into the world of everybody being super offended. You've got Raheem Sterling saying, ban them, dock them 9 points for racism. So, like, it's like VAR. What's the definition of racism? You know, I'm meant to be sitting on a Monday morning saying this comment is, but that one is on the edge and I'll give him 9 points less and them not. It's nonsense. It's absolutely nonsense. Now, from what I see as I've grown up and I work a lot in London, I have to say I sense zero racism in the environments that I work in. It's totally beyond thinking that anybody thinks a black person or an Asian or a Muslim in any way is inferior and different in London these days. Now, you can get examples of people that are, but again, they're thick. You know, they're people that, So let me kind of like argue against myself a little bit when people say, yeah, well...
Well, save me the trouble. Carry on.
Yeah. you can come back in a minute, but let me finish this. You know, so people say, yeah, that's all very well, but, you know, you try if it was your son and you're in the stand and there's the monkey noises. I don't know, but all I can go is in what I am, you know? If it was my son, I would take him at the end of the game and I would say, you know why they're doing that, don't you? They're jealous and they're angry and they will never be like you. It's a compliment. Move on. Now, that's myself and it's what I would say to my son. Why is this such a big thing? It's a reflection on them. That guy who was making those monkey gestures, he's a dick. He is recognised as a dick. He's on social media as a dick. It's over. He got what he deserved. Let's just move on.
Well, look, I hate agreeing with you, Roger, but I do. I mean, and that's exactly how I would handle it too. But in the wider context, it's difficult for quote-unquote authorities to not be seen to be doing something, right? That's the problem. It's those guys in suits. They have to be seen to be doing something. Look, we all know growing up that, you know, if people make fun of you, ignore them, and they just eventually give up and go away because they're looking for the reaction, right? Which is what this is.
Yeah,
it's just,
absolutely.
It's on a much more malevolent level, unfortunately. And it is awful, and it is, you know, bile, and it is all the things you've said. I would handle it like you did just then. That's exactly what I would do, to the letter. But I don't know if that's you and I and the product of the environment we grew up in, where it really was a case of sticks and stones may break
that's
my
it.
Bones kind of thing. Just get
it.
Just ignore them, right? And that was always what my parents would say, just ignore them. And they were right at the time. I don't know if that works today. I don't know if just ignore them works anymore, simply because back then they could come at you in the playground with a few taunts. Now they can make your life misery on social media and, you know, in any number of ways. So I don't know if just ignore them works anymore. Maybe it does and we just haven't tried it, but I don't know, Rog. I really don't.
Yeah. So listen, Balotelli, I think it's tragic, his career. Having heard what I just said, this will probably sound strange, but I do think it's affected him. I think in Italy, especially here, you know, and you had this thing in Italy, I don't know whether you saw it, Grant, you know, they did this crazy front page of one of the sports papers, Black Friday, where they put Lukaku and Chris Smalling, who were playing in the game that night on a Friday with Roma at Inter Milan.
Oh, Jesus.
And did you not see that?
No, I didn't.
So like, they put the big picture of them, you know, like, my front page, Black Friday. And the thing is, obviously, a huge reaction and everything. But the thing is, in Italy, they don't see that. And it's something that is too intellectual for us to try and get into, because it's, you know, you would spend hours. The fact is, in Italy, their relationship with what they would call non-Indigenous whites is often terms of endearment. You know, like, they will call the little black boy exactly that and have no malice in it at all. In the main. Now, and I know the director of the newspaper, Zazzaroni, who did that, and he's not a racist. But he felt that was okay. So there's obviously been 6, 8, 10 people who have said, yeah, that's a good front page, let's go with it. And I'm pretty sure none of them are racist. And it's because they just don't get it. They haven't had the exposure to the multicultural society that everybody else has had. The same as Eastern Europe, the same as Spain, the same as Italy. It's,
yeah.
You know, but in Balotelli's case, I followed my son in amateur youth football in Italy, and the parents are because they're crazy. They think their son is going to be their meal ticket out of their life and become a superstar, and they put so much pressure on their boy because, you know, you get out of there, you become a big player. And what they say, what comes out of their mouth, is absolutely astonishing. You know, and maybe I am sounding completely contradicting myself from what I said earlier. But honestly, if I was a little kid of 10, 11, 12, 13, and all I heard from a stand full of like 70 folk, most of which are parents and friends, and some of them are shouting what they were shouting, Balotelli must have had a lot of rage in him. And I don't think that's helped him. Listen, he's got a bad character. He's probably not somebody that wants to take advice. He's a hothead. He's stubborn. But, you know, I kind of feel I want to cut my break, as usual. Nuanced, you know, I've spoken for 10 minutes and probably it sounds completely contradictory, but life is like that sometimes. It's not black and white.
Well, it comes down to intent, ultimately, right? I mean, if the intent of the newspaper editors was, you know, they felt a clever pun.
Clever pun.
Then, you know, that's one thing. However, making that kind of clever pun with your mates down the pub who you know, and you know that they will understand it's a pun and they'll know it's a joke and they know you're not a racist, is one thing. Splashing it over the banner headlines of a newspaper when it goes out to an entire nation, many of whom, you know, will take offence to it, and justifiably so in their case. If they don't know, the intent behind it. I'm staggered by that, Roger. And I absolutely take your point that it does not mean categorically that the guy who did it is a racist. That's, I think, is the problem we make, is that you jump to conclusions about the people. Now, could that be construed as a racist statement? Yes.
Absolutely.
Does it absolutely mean that the guy who made it is a racist? No. But you know, you talk about black and white and shades of grey. That's the problem there, right?
Yeah.
No one ever bothers to say, well, hang on a second, what do we know about this guy? Was it just a bad joke that went wrong, which doesn't mean he's a racist? I don't know the guy.
It's like Bernardo Silva, you know, like, right, he's not a racist.
That was way more ridiculous, right? Because that was two guys who were mates, had a relationship, were friends, and he clearly felt that was a level upon which he could joke with his friend. Now, to choose to do it on social media is probably just lazy. He probably was on Twitter, it came up, and he just put it on Twitter instead of a text to his mate.
We've all done that.
Yeah, but... you know, it's. I think the race to judgment these days is one of the biggest problems we face. The fact that, to your point, there is no nuance, there is no time in the news cycle to pick something apart, understand the people's motivations, and say to them, look, you know what, that wasn't such a good idea, and him to go, you know what, on reflection, it wasn't, and then, as you said earlier on, move on. These things get blown up and become global sensations rather than local ones. I mean, if the rest of the world hadn't found out about, you know, I hadn't heard about it until you told me, right? So it wasn't a problem for me. I had made no judgment about that guy. But a lot of the world will have done, simply because that headline, the sensationalist, would have been taken out of context in terms of a cultural identity in Italy and splashed all over the world papers and been judged through the prism of that particular nation, which is completely different.
Yeah, very difficult conversation. I'd just like to try and in some way say a couple of things. What I said before, football and football grounds in many ways still are that release pressure valve that is needed in society. So don't throw on them more than they can handle. They actually have got a role to play. Secondly, trying to bring politics, value signaling, telling people how they should be thinking, like Rapinoe, is wrong. And even if it wasn't wrong, it is totally unmanageable. Let me tell you that as somebody who's been in that position, you cannot be judging who gets a 9-point penalty and who doesn't. You would be all week dealing with videos like this, all week. VAR is already enough. So let's get off our high horse. Let's get pragmatic, look on the positive sides, and the positive is, in 2019, that guy and his mates were caught in camera, and he has been fucking hammered. I believe he's also lost his job. Fuck him. So let's move on. It's not football's problem. Football has already punished him.
Yeah, all right, well, I take your point, Rog. I take your point. And I have to say, this is a nice segue. If we got nothing out of that conversation, other than the fact that it gave people a chance to hear the Glaswegian pronunciation of police for the first time, then we've done the world a favor. But I'm gonna segue nicely, actually. This has worked out really well from the hostile environment that you've been describing to my goal this week, which is the complete opposite, and that is because I went to Fulham on Saturday. I was here for work, and part of it just by way of some an interesting change of venue. We held an event at Craven Cottage on Saturday before the Bristol City match. And my goal is twofold. It is the extraordinary atmosphere at Fulham Football Club, which, you know, is dear to my heart. And the second part of my goal is my own dad, who came along just for the match, which was fantastic. And, you know, we took 25 people there, I think. Well, actually, maybe more than that, 30-odd people there, most of whom were from overseas. People had come in from Singapore, New Zealand, all over the US, the Middle East, Europe, I mean, everywhere. And they were just a wonderful, wonderful group of people, diverse in their culture.
This was the blacklist.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
Real vision.
It was absolutely fantastic, right? And so we spent the morning in a place called The Flag, which is corporate hospitality at Fulham, which is a room under the stand that used to be the press room. It used to be the sort of players bar, but they've now decked it out for sort of hospitality. And look, it's nothing like you'd see at Manchester United or Arsenal, Liverpool, and that's what's so beautiful about it. It's
proper.
A small room. It's a bar with photos, you know, going back to the 1900s of the history of Fulham Football Club, which for me was fantastic. You know, I got to be in there with my dad, who at 80 is just an extraordinary man. He's so sharp and he's so lucid and he's so passionate about Fulham. And, you know, to watch him stand there and tell this group of people a little bit about his history of Fulham, we worked out this is the 70th year he's been going to Craven Cottage. His first game was in 1949. It was just wonderful. And the club looked after us so well. The atmosphere in the ground, you know, you had a bunch of people there who'd never been to a quote unquote soccer match, who I know will all be diehard Fulham fans now.
Yeah.
Even if they follow Man United or Arsenal, they'll always have a place in their heart for Fulham because it's that kind of club, you know, there's no trouble. And the Bristol City fans were amazing. I mean, just sang their hearts out the whole game. And the beauty of it was, as my dad and I were saying afterwards, yeah, Fulham lost 2-1. Dominated possession, dreadful refereeing decisions, had a stone-cold penalty denied in injury time, hit the bar in injury time to lose 2-1. So I said to all the people, it was their first game, I said, now you have the quintessential Fulham experience. If we'd have won, you wouldn't have got the joke. This is what it's all about. And after the game, you know, we went back to the place and in walks a gentleman called Gordon Davis, who nobody will have heard of.
I know he is.
You'll know who he is. Yeah. When I was a kid, he was my idol. This guy,
really?
He's Fulham's top goal scorer in history.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he was knocking him in for fun when I was, you know, when I was the perfect age, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, you know, those sort of years.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know some
don't
of these
ex-pros.
Don't
tell me you went up and you've made a fool of yourself. Don't tell me.
No, I didn't. I don't think I made a fool of myself. Only Gordon can tell you that, really.
Right,
but,
right.
But I know a lot of these ex-pros, they're on corporate duty and they come in and they tell their stories.
They don't have a lot of money either, and that's their gig and
but a lot of it feels like sort of dance boy dance kind of thing, you know.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah.
I tell you what, me and my dad chatted with Gordon for well over an hour and he was just wonderful. And I said to him, I said, Gordon, I don't know what's happened. I said, but you know, you were my idol when I was a kid and you were so much older than me then, and now you're only 12 years older than me. What the hell happened? You know, he's 64. He looks fitter than I've ever looked in my life. But what a wonderful, warm, friendly man who just sat there for an hour telling us stories, talking about the modern game. And it was just, the whole day was so special. There's something about the environment at Fulham Football Club. And to be able to share that with my dad and have a day with him and let him meet all these people that I've come into contact with over the years and let him kind of share his love for Fulham with them. It was just a fantastic day. And it's, you know, as goals go, it's a very personal one.
Oh, it's beautiful.
It fits beautifully.
I've got nothing to say.
No, it fits beautifully against your hostile environment, you know?
Yeah, no, I get it. I get absolutely. I can smell, I can taste that the way you've described it. It's beautiful. And tell me, were the stories that he was telling you, you know, what was your dad thinking about them, you know, coming from somebody that was out in the field? What, I'm interested to hear how your dad experienced that whole day, and especially Gordon.
Oh, look, he loved it as much as I did. I mean, I think for both of us, for me, as much fun as it was to be able to share it, my dad was the highlight. And I think it was the same for him to share it with his son, you know. And that's one of the good things that football does. You know, it does. It brings father and son together with a love for something that transcends everything else. And it's, you know, I was telling my dad told a few stories about the about, you know, his history with the club to everybody there, and you know, talked about how he taught me to drive on our way up to Fulham every week, you know, and stuff like that. And I'll tell you the one story I told just to bring it down back to Fulham at the end, because he created this very rose-hued vision of Fulham Football Club. And I recalled a midweek game in like February or something in the cup against Carlisle United. And I'd been away in Tokyo for 3 years. And I hadn't really been to a Fulham game for 3 years. And we used to stand at the Hammersmith end with all the home fans. And it was a cold, miserable midwinter night. And I said to my dad, I said, come on, Dad, my treat, we're going to sit in the stands and we're going to get tickets on the halfway line. So we walk into the ground and we walk to Stevenage Road stand, which is when you see Fulham on the TV, that's the stand you're looking at, uh-huh, with Fulham Football Club written above it. And, it's an old, the other side of it, outside the ground, it's all brick. It's been there for 100 years. It's
on the Thames, for people that don't know, beautiful setting.
It's fabulous. And we walked in and we get to, blocks, I think it was G and H. So I go first into the turnstiles, those really thin old turnstiles. And I said to the guy, I said, two, please, because you could buy tickets on the gate back then. I said, but can you make sure they're in block G? Because I knew that G was on actually the block on the halfway line. And without looking up, he said to me, you can sit where you fucking like, mate. didn't make eye contact. We walked through the turnstiles. We walked up to the seats.
No eye contact.
It was me. I swear to God, you didn't even look up. Me, my dad, like six other people. And as I remember it, Fulham scored first. We then went 5-1 down. And back then you had the seats, and at the bottom of the seats there was a standing area that ran the length of the pitch.
Yeah.
And we were 5-1 down, and there was a guy, passionate fan in the standing area down the bottom. And at 5-1 down, the linesman flagged a Fulham player offside, out near the touchline. Yeah,
game's dead. Not a material 5-1 down, issue.
There's 5-1 down, there's 3 minutes left, right? The linesman's flagged him for offside near the touchline, right? And for the last 2.5 minutes of injury time, this fan was chasing the linesman up and down the line, just shouting, you know you're wrong, linesman. And that's the other side of the sort of the football.
Yeah.
To record,
there's no rationality. There's no rationality.
None.
Don't try and make it rational. You got to accept the shit that comes from their rationality as well as those beautiful moments. I mean, that's fucking magic.
Well, you know, he'd have gone home and said to his mates, they lost 5-1. What was
wife.
The game like? Oh, the linesman was terrible. There was this one decision. He flagged the guy offside. God love him.
Oh, God.
But Roger, I've got to say, I think that probably, at least it wraps things up on a slightly more upbeat note for the week.
Super. Great stuff. Listen, all
that remains, I guess, is for us to say our thank yous to those listening. My personal thanks to Fulham Football Club, to Gordon Davis. And I have to say, I miss Les Strongout, who was a fantastic defender back in the day. We didn't get much of a chance to chat with Les. He was in and out. But again, lovely fella. They looked after us incredibly well. If anyone's listening to this who was amongst our group there, thank you for a wonderful, wonderful day. And it really was something that I will treasure for a very, very long time. So,
splendid.
For those of you listening, thank you to you. Please do share the podcast with your mates, post it on social media, rate and review us on iTunes. All of that really, really helps us. You can find us on Twitter at EntertainedR, that's the word, A-R-E. And you can find me on Twitter, should you be so inclined, at TTMYGH.
And you can find myself at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Rog, as always, mate, what
thanks.
Fun.
Take care. Thanks, Grant. Bye.